The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our last show for 2017. Happy New Year to everyone. You know, there have been a lot of negative things said about social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, but as a journalist who loves to learn about new people, projects, and ideas, these platforms have often been a great source of information. And so it is with my first guest this evening. Out of a chance post on Facebook, we will once again be headed all the way around the world to meet an American who has moved to New Zealand and for the past 11 years has lived with her wife, Karen, in Christchurch, riding, working, and living with their adorable corgis, the Queen's dogs, if you will. Evelyn comes from the East Coast, where she grew up a pretty normal kid. Her grandmother, Evelyn Budd Fishburne, was a fairly well-known artist, and Evelyn was named after her. To me, where the story begins to diverge from, quote, a normal kid growing up in America, end quote, is when Evelyn couldn't find a job in her field and enlisted in the Coast Guard to get the technical training she wanted. We'll pick up the story and find out when bicycles actually became an important part of her life as everything shifted to the West Coast. Then, after a break, it's time to wrap up 2017 in preparation for the 2018 riding and racing season. I'm going to my man in the know, Dan Worry, for a he-says-she-says conversation as we tick off some of the best cycling stories from 2017 and take a peek at what's coming up in the new year. Lastly, I'd like to say thank you. Thank you to all of you who listen to the show both regularly and when the mood strikes. This past year, I've covered a lot of what I believe to be truly interesting topics, reviewed a lot of books, spoken with some amazing people, and generally had the privilege of bringing my style of audio journalism to you. Many of you have given me great ideas for guests and stories, and it is my hope that you will continue to do so. Moving on into 2018, I plan to bring you another exceptional year of bicycling podcasts and broadcasts. Keep listening. Keep giving me your feedback. Have a happy, healthy, and safe 2018. And let's head on over to Christchurch, New Zealand, for a conversation with Evelyn Bourne. Hello, Evelyn. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy New Year, and thank you for joining me today.
Same to you, and thanks for having me.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me how people get to know one another without the bother of, you know, a proper face-to-face introduction. And through the magic medium of social interaction, you and I have been kind of talking to one another for a while now. So can we begin our conversation today with a quick background on you? And I'm really interested in your Coast Guard days and the reason then for your move to the West Coast after being born, raised, and educated in Massachusetts.
You know, I had a typical middle-class upbringing. In the 60s and 70s, I had three brothers, two older and one younger. And I was raised in Buzzards Bay, Mass., which is in the town of Bourne, just at the beginning of the Cape. My dad was a highway surveyor. My mom was a teacher. And the area where I grew up, my dad had 30 acres, basically. Some of it was shore property and some was a private woodlot. So I had a huge playground to play around with. We'd have the kids near us. So a lot of times I'd go off on my own. And we always had bikes to get from point A to point B, or my dad taught me to sail, so I'd go out sailing a lot of times. And I went to school. It was a private Catholic school, Sacred Heart in Kingston, and it was an hour bus ride each way. Either my mom or dad would take a bus stop to catch a bus. We were raised Catholic. I don't practice now, but it was just your normal, typical upbringing, basically. And then after I graduated high school in 77, I went to a university at University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, New Brunswick in Canada. I knew when I got out of high school that I wanted to do some kind of practical science. So I ended up getting a Bachelor of Science degree in forestry. And unfortunately, back in 1982, when I got my degree, there was not a lot of work. And I was kind of tired of paying for my own education. So I decided I'd join the Coast Guard and get some technical training and let them pay for it. So I joined the Coast Guard in 83. And I went to basic training in Cape May, New Jersey. And then after my basic training, I was sent to Japan, just outside of Tokyo. The Coast Guard would do LORAN support. Basically, this was before the age of GPS and everybody having GPSs and everything. A lot of ships would use. It was an Air Force base just outside of Tokyo. And the Coast Guard provided support to the guys that were in the remote LORAN stations in different areas. And I was in Japan for about 10 months. I did a little bit of traveling and seeing different sites and things. And then I went to Governor's Island, New York, back in 83. They had electronics training school in Governor's Island. And they also had some ships stationed there, basically right in the middle of New York Harbor. You could see the Statue of Liberty from there. And so I was there for a couple of months for that electronics training. So I was in Governor's Island, and Governor's Island is basically end of Manhattan. I was there for 2 months. And for basic electronics training. And then I was sent to Mare Island in Vallejo, California, for some cryptographic technical training. And I was there for a couple months. And it was at Mare Island that I met my now wife, Karen. She was in the Navy, and she was there for technical training as well.
So what was it like 30-some-odd years ago to meet Karen and have a relationship that you really couldn't talk about?
Yeah, it was big no-no. So you know that you really like somebody and you want to start a relationship, but you just keep it secret. And basically we'd go off on our own and do things. But like we only knew each other for about 2 weeks. And then I was sent to Kodiak Island in Alaska. And I was sent there for 2 years. So Kodiak Island in Alaska is beautiful. Hunting and fishing, you consider it a paradise. But if you don't like hunting and fishing, you kind of like just deal with whatever happens because it rains there a lot. And so Karen and I kept our long relationship going. She was sent to San Diego, California, where she was stationed with the Navy.
So,
you still hear me?
Yeah, I can. I wanted to ask you a question about the Coast Guard before we move on to coming back to California. So my husband always thought that if he had joined the service, that he would join the Coast Guard. What was it about the Coast Guard that you picked that branch of the service than, say, the Navy?
The Coast Guard is a smaller service. And where I grew up in the Cape, I was exposed more to the Coast Guard. You know, I was into sailing and things like that. And so I didn't want to join a huge service. And so that's kind of why I was drawn to the Coast Guard at that point.
Got it. Okay, let's truck on out back to California. And let's talk a little bit about the reason you got into cycling. Sanity, I think, is probably the main issue. But tell us a little bit about your bicycling experience, because it kind of became a bug in your ear or something.
Get out of the Coast Guard. I went to San Diego, and basically Karen and I moved in together. And I started commuting to bike by work because I originally went, I was able to get a job with a IT type company, and I worked in the field a lot and traveled around a lot. And then at a certain point, I got promoted as a operations supervisor manager and was in the office all the time. And so to relieve stress, I started commuting to work by bike, basically. It was an hour commute each way. And I was like a minimum of people who would commute to work, basically, by bike. People thought I was crazy, of course.
Of course.
You didn't see a lot of people commuting by bike in California. People drive their cars everywhere. So
put that in the context of time. When was that? What year?
That would have been in 89, 90 type time frame.
Yeah, you were a little ahead of your time, I'd say.
Yeah. And, you know, you just, because the cars are always going to win no matter if you're right or not. So
that's true.
And when I got the bike bug, basically, after I started commuting, I started wanting to do events and things like that just to see if I could do them. I wasn't into racing or anything. I just enjoyed cycling. So I'd do longer rides, and I'd also do some events and things like that. But I just enjoyed going out on my own. I wasn't really into cycling with a bunch of other people. I was more into riding on my own. Enjoying whatever me time type.
So you got a Trek Project One.
I did. I got that. My first decent road bike was a Cannondale. And then when I was doing lots and lots of riding, I decided I wanted to get a really nice bike, and I got a Trek Project One. I don't know I'd ever do it again because, you know, after having it for a couple of months, of course, you get a scratch. And then it's like, all right, you have this custom paint job. It's got a scratch in it.
Yeah, but tell them what the custom paint job said.
It was a flame motif, and you could get whatever logo you want on it. So I put Bitch on Wheels on it just because it seemed to suit me.
Really?
Would call me that. Go ahead.
I was just going to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Evelyn Bourne. She is in New Zealand. She is an American, but she is also a New Zealander now as a citizen in the country so, so far away from me. I wanted to ask one question to back up. Your last name is Bourne, and the town you were born in is Bourne, or the town you were raised. What is the connection there?
Way, way back when. Bourne is a big time Cape Cod name. If you looked up Bourne in the phone book where I grew up, is very, very, as common a name as Smith. And way back, my ancestors on my dad's side of the family go way, way back.
God,
was it old Cape Cod? And like New Bedford, which is near, they were into whaling and things like that.
You also have a famous grandmother.
Oh, yes. My grandmother was a professional artist. That's who I'm named for, Evelyn Bodfish Bourne.
Yeah, I looked at some of her work before I called you.
Yeah, all her paintings, a lot of them, she dealt mostly in watercolor. And a lot of her work show the different areas where I grew up and everything. She was trained in New York, and she would also, my dad would travel to her Sarasota, Florida, where the carnival, the circus wintered in the, would spend winters there. So she went to Sarasota, Florida one time, and I've got some paintings of hers that show like merry-go-rounds and some circus scenes and lots of different things like that.
That sounds cool. I want to fast forward in your life a little bit. And so you were in California, you and Karen are together. In 2005, you'd been together 20 years, and your non-bicycling partner says to you, how about a bike trip?
Yeah, she said to me, she wanted to know if I was interested in doing a bike trip. And of course, as a person who bikes all the time, it's like, yeah, I'm like, are you sure? Because she didn't really cycle or anything. And she said, yeah, you know, initially she wanted to take me to France to see the Tour de France.
Nice.
And I'm not a big crowd person. So, you know, I'm more about if I'm going to watch that kind of stuff, I'm great with seeing it on TV. But if I saw it in person, it would probably drive me crazy. But we found a company, VBT Bike Tours, that had tours in New Zealand, and they were pretty reasonably priced. So I got really interested in that. So we came over here in 2005 and went to the South Island and did a basic organized bike tour where they take your stuff from place to place. You can ride as much as you want or as little as you want, which suited Karen because I would ride, you know, as much as possible, and she'd ride for a few hours, and it suited us both. And when I came to New Zealand, I had no intention of falling in love with the country, but it felt like home, basically. When I was here the whole time, I just, my blood pressure dropped, and I'm like, I don't want to go back to the States. I could just stay here and not go home at all.
What is it about New Zealand that is so compelling to you? Of course, I've seen documentaries, and I've seen photos, and I've talked to people who live in New Zealand. They love it. What was it that was so different to you?
It's a small country, and the New Zealand people are very friendly. They're very accepting. Like Karen's in my relationship, people are like, that's nice. We're glad to hear you've been together so long. And they just take it in their stride, and they accept you for who you are. And it's just much more relaxing. When we were in the States, we'd be on our guard all the time with our relationship. But here in New Zealand, people don't care. They just, like I said, accept you for who you are. And they're just very friendly, very welcoming. The majority of the population is on the North Island, and the South Island is not as populated. The country is about 4.5 million people. South Island, just beautiful landscape and very rugged landscape in areas. And we're in Christchurch. And back in 2010 and 2011, of course, we had earthquakes here, which were pretty devastating to the city. Luckily, we didn't sustain that much damage. I've been back to the States once since I've been here. I went back in 2008. And Karen's been back twice. And I really don't miss very much from the States. There's we used to like a restaurant, P.F. Chang's.
Right.
That's probably one of the only things I really miss are some really good friends. But, you know, we both love it here. And with the political situation in the States, we're very glad we made the decision to move here and we're citizens here. So, you know, we're very comfortable with what we did. It wasn't like we had a premonition or anything,
right.
But I just love it here.
What is your job there?
I work for an IT service provider. They do a lot of hosting and storage that companies do these days. They have a big data center.
And what does Karen do?
She basically helps run a small company that imports Linda McCartney vegetarian foods from the UK.
Huh. How cool is that?
Yeah.
I talked with an author last week by the name of David Coventry. He wrote a book called The Invisible Mile, and he lives in Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
And the bio said he lives on the side of a hill. And he said to me, oh, did that get into the bio? I said, yeah. He says, well, it's not a big deal. Every place, everything's on the side of a hill. So are you on the side of a hill?
No, I'm at the bottom of the hills. But Wellington is a very hilly city.
Yeah.
Wellington's the capital. It's at the bottom of the North Island, basically.
How far is that from you?
You'd have to either fly or you take a ferry across between the two islands.
Oh, I see. I see.
I'm kind of in the coast of the South Island in Christchurch. There's either flat land or there's hill, depending on what you want to ride and what the weather's like type thing. I like a combination of hills and flat when I ride.
What is the weather like?
It doesn't get super, super cold like in the winters. It can be around freezing at night. And during the day, it might get to a high of, say, in the 40s. In the summer, in November this year, we had a like temperatures in the 70s and 80s and no rain at all for the month of November, which is very unusual. Usually you get a little bit of rain. It doesn't get super cold and it doesn't get super warm. And when it does get warm, you're not used to it anymore.
Right. So. Right. So what about the riding? So I know you ride, you try to ride almost every day.
Pretty much on average ride 6 days out of the week. And the roads are narrow. They can be narrow and windy. And they're also pretty rough because they don't use regular tar seal here. They'll put the tar down and then they'll put the gritty type gravel stuff on it. So the roads can be pretty rough.
What are you riding these days?
These days I have a Focus. It's actually a cyclocross bike that I put road tires on. They're 32 is the width on them, and it's a much more comfortable ride. It's got disc brakes, and it's much more comfortable on these roads, especially. I can be up in the hills in like a half hour, so I'll either ride up the hills or around the bays, depending on what the weather's like and what kind of ride I want to do.
When you left the States, Karen stayed for a while and then came back over with your dog, right? Your corgi?
Yeah, we found out when we were doing research on moving here that if you have a dog and you want to bring him from the States, they need to do a rabies test 6 months before and then right before, because they don't have rabies in New Zealand. There's a lot of things they don't have here, so they're just really, really strict. It was an expensive process. It was basically his college education is what I always like to say. $3,500 basically. Wow. To bring him over, but since he's a member of the family, couldn't not bring him over.
Of course.
So that was Potter, and he was named for Harry Potter because he had markings around his eyes when we saw him and made us think of Harry Potter. Called him Potter for short.
Yeah. He was cute. I saw pictures of him.
Yeah. 6 years ago, he got sick and we had to put him to sleep. And we found a breeder on the North Island in Hastings who had a female that had the exact same birthday as him. And it turned out she had imported his sister from the States and she had just bred her. So we've now got two corgis that are from that litter of hers, Mocha and Bailey. And, you know, they keep us busy and keep us young. Corgis are full of personality and they can be challenging, but they're still a lot of fun and high energy. They love running around.
Well, Evelyn, you know, this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm sorry we've had so many challenges with Skype, but I have other questions I have to ask you. One is, what's your favorite food and is it something that we couldn't get here in the States?
Your food, and I didn't catch the second part.
Is it something that we can't get here in the States, your favorite food?
My favorite food's probably Chinese.
Can you get good Chinese in New Zealand?
I'm used to in the States, so I've kind of taken to eating more Indian food. I like Indian. You can get some good Indian food here or Thai.
Good. And what about music? What kind of music do you like to listen to?
A wide range. I'm not into heavy metal type music. I'm more into the more mellow stuff, you know, like Indigo Girls or I like Sheryl Crow or Melissa Etheridge or even Bruce Hornsby.
Nice.
It's kind of, like I said, a wide range of music. And there's more and more artists actually coming here to New Zealand because a lot of musicians don't come because you don't get the huge crowds. But last year we saw the Dixie Chicks. So we do get more and more musicians coming here to New Zealand.
Are you seeing more Americans moving down there?
Most of the people who migrate here come from the UK or from South Africa. Because New Zealand still falls under, I mean, they're self-ruling and everything, but they do still fall under the Queen, basically.
Evelyn Bourne joined me from her home in Christchurch, New Zealand. We had a lot of difficulty with the Skype connection, so I hope that the choppiness of the interview is made up for by the conversation. After talking with her, it does make me want to take that long trip to see the other side of the world. So let's take a break. And when we come back, it's time to wrap up 2017 with VeloNews' Dan Worry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and it's off to South Carolina for my year-end wrap-up conversation with journalist Dan Worry. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, it is our turn to wrap up 2017 for listeners, and I think you and I have some interesting stories to relay. I'm wondering whether we should let our listeners in on all of our favorite stories or not, but I guess maybe we should. What do you think?
Oh, well, all right, let's do it.
All right, that's fine. So I'm going to let you begin. You and I have sort of decided you're going to do sort of the racing stuff, and I'm going to do the non-racing stuff for competitive, but we'll see how it turns out. Go ahead. What's your first story? You're one of your favorites from 2017.
Well, I don't know if I'd describe it as a favorite or even a memory from 2017, but, you know, clearly I think the biggest story in 2017 from a pro cycling perspective is one that is still unfolding, Diane, and that is that Chris Froome of Team Sky is finding himself in some very serious peril right now with anti-doping authorities. Froome, of course, is a four-time Tour de France winner. He's a member of Britain's Team Sky. And your listeners probably know that he won both the Tour de France and the Vuelta a España during 2017, which is something that hasn't happened since the late 70s. So a really major accomplishment to win those two Grand Tours back to back. It is well known that Froome, though, has exercise-induced asthma. And so what happened is that he tested not positive for a banned substance, but had what is known as an adverse analytical finding. Basically, the concentration of his asthma medication, salbutamol, or which some of you, some of the listeners probably know as albuterol. It's the inhaler that you take for asthma.
Right.
So the concentration of that asthma medication in his urine was tested after a Vuelta stage and was basically twice the permissible threshold. Now, salbutamol is, you know, not a banned substance, and it's important to say that. I think when we talk about doping, a lot of the time we're talking about riders taking things that are prohibited. Salbutamol is not prohibited, but it is what's known as a threshold substance, which means that you can only have so much of it. They limit how much of it you can have in a 24-hour period, recognizing that, you know, many asthmatics and you know, many who participate in endurance sports end up with this exercise-induced version of it, and it's pretty well known that Froome has that. In fact, we've seen over and over throughout the years video of him using an asthma inhaler even during races. So no surprise that he uses this medication and needs this medication, but the problem is that he is double the permissible limit here. And so that is a major concern. There are riders, including Diego Ulisi just a couple of years ago, who actually served bans for having, you know, had an excess amount of salbutamol in their system. So this is a very big deal for a four-time Tour de France winner. Froome insists that he did nothing wrong and did not exceed the permissible limit. And there is some logic to that. If nothing else, Diane, you know, this is a guy who had just won the Tour de France, who was in the leader's position in the Vuelta. He knew he was being tested every single day. I mean, this is, it would be crazy to some extent to be gambling too much on that sort of thing, knowing that he'd be going through anti-doping testing. And, you know, there are some studies that suggest that it is possible and that different people process those medications and metabolize those medications at different rates. So basically they look at how much of it is in your urine. That can be, determined in part by exercise and how dehydrated you are. And so You know, this is a case that is sort of still unfolding. You know, it's not a not a case where Froom at this point has been found to be guilty specifically of anything, but definitely some major concern and peril for him right now. He will end up going through what is known as pharmacokinetic testing, where they will try to kind of recreate these conditions in the lab, and we'll see where that goes from here. But certainly, you know, the top pro racing headline of 2017 is that our Tour de France winner, a four-time winner, is having trouble with anti-doping authorities right now.
Yeah, and it almost seems like people want him to be wrong. You know, it's sort of like, let's make him a villain because he's doing so well. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see. So, you know, this year, heart issues have been a big deal. Athletes, endurance athletes especially, have been having serious heart problems, ranging from books like The Haywire Heart to Gabe Merkin's Ezine. And now there's a report by the Cardiovascular Associations that there's truly something to the problem of overtraining. So this comes from TCTMD Online, the Cardiovascular Association. A gentleman named Michael O'Rourdan wrote it. And the headline is enough to scare the crap out of you. Competitive triathletes show evidence of myocardial fibrosis. So in an effort not to scare the crap out of you, the subtitle reads, so it's sort of one of these maybe, but yes. Despite the finding, experts say the long-term significance of myocardial scarring is unknown, and athletes shouldn't yet, and the yet is there, parenthetically, needlessly worry. So, you know, we talked to Leonard Zinn probably a year ago now, maybe a year and a little more, and he evidently had to stop doing a lot of his competitive stuff. This particular study shows more that males than females have this problem in a cohort of 54 male and 29 female triathletes who train more than 10 hours per week. Non-ischemic focal fibrosis was detected by late gadolinium enhancement, which is some sort of cardiac magnetic resonance imaging, in 9 athletes, all of whom were male. So watch out, Dan. The male athletes with myocardial fibrosis participated in longer races, particularly longer swimming and cycling events, and were more likely to participate in middle and Ironman distance triathlons. So everybody knows at least one athlete who died suddenly during exercise. It happens all over the world. That's the guy who actually figured this out, Gunnar Lund. He says it indicates some kind of damage to the heart, but we don't know whether these smaller myocardial scars will have an impact on heart function. It is an aspect we need to further analyze. We know that patients with fibrosis can develop cardiac arrhythmias, and these arrhythmias can result in sudden cardiac death. This is our general concern. Everybody knows of at least one athlete who died suddenly. So I think it's something to watch going forward, that, you know, these sort of middle-aged men who get out there and go nuts are having some heart issues. I don't know. Do you know anybody like that?
Any middle-aged men who get out there and go nuts on a bike? Yeah, I know one of those at least.
But you're not having heart issues.
Not having heart issues, but it definitely is something to take note of.
Right, exactly. What's next?
So my next 2017 story, Diane, is sort of a more of a memory, certainly, than the Froom story, but also one that has a very recent update, and that is, you might recall that during the fourth stage of the Tour de France this year, Peter Sagan, our world champion, was actually disqualified from the Tour de France and thrown out of the race.
Right.
There was a crash in the sprint finish there during that fourth stage that resulted in Mark Cavendish of Team Dimension Data having a broken shoulder. And so Sagan and Cavendish encountered one another during this sprint. There was a question of, you know, whether Sagan held his line and had an irregular sprint, but also this question of whether or not Cavendish's crash was caused by Peter Sagan throwing an elbow at him during in at least one of the video tapes of this sprint coming, the sort of facing forward, the front facing video of this sprint, it definitely appears, Sagan's elbow goes out to the right, Cavendish goes down. It appears from the front very much as though, the two were connected and that, that Sagan's elbow was actually the cause of Cavendish's crash. Within a couple of hours, though, of that crash happening, and actually, a couple hours after he was thrown out of the race by the race jury, different angles of this video came to light and were pretty widely shared on social media, which really raised the question of whether there was even contact between the two of them, really cast the whole thing into doubt. It appears from the other angle of the video, very much like Cavendish was already in the process of going down, trying to fit into a space where he didn't belong or certainly wasn't going to make it through up against the barriers. And it looks very much to my review, Diane, and looked at the time, as though Cavendish sort of comes up behind Sagan, lodges his brake hood under Sagan's arm. Sagan then sort of lifts his arm to disentangle from the brake hood that has been shoved under his arm from behind. And it really doesn't even appear from the other angle as though there was even contact. And so, lots of people were outraged by this at the time. The race jury threw him out based only on that sort of forward-facing video and not the subsequent video that came into play. And unfortunately, chose not to, I think, but within a couple hours of this whole thing happening, they had access to this other video. We certainly had access to it on social media. They chose not to overturn their decision. And, Peter Sagan, who was a multi-time winner of the green points jersey in the Tour de France, was excluded from that point in the race. Now, the update to this, interestingly, is that his team, Bora Hansgrohe and Peter Sagan, actually had planned to take this to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, CAS. There was a settlement in this case here very recently, here just in the past couple of days. The UCI now admits that they were wrong, that Sagan did not cause the crash. And the exciting thing to come out of this, Diane, is that they will now be piloting during 2018, adding now a video judge. Not to every UCI race, but to the very large ones, to Paris-Roubaix and to the Grand Tours and so on. So we'll be piloting the use of a video judge as part of that race jury during our biggest events here for the coming year. And hopefully that's something that we'll see going forward. There was really no excuse for Sagan's disqualification for the Tour. And, a sad game of what could have been. Velenews actually predicted that Sagan could have won up to 11 stages during that Tour. And so to be disqualified on the fourth stage is a really sad thing.
So I wonder if there, I don't know what happened with the arbitration, and obviously he was exonerated, but there is no way to get any of this back. It's sort of like in a vacuum that, yeah, okay, and it is changing the rules, which I think is really, really good. But going backwards, you can't do it. So I don't know. Peter Sagan, what I thought was very gracious during the entire thing.
I have to agree with you and has been very gracious even now. Frankly, I'm not sure what would have come, had it gone to CAS and had they ruled in Sagan's favor. Certainly they can't rerun the Tour de France.
Right.
And so I'm not sure what the outcome there would have been. I'm also not certain, and this is total speculation, I don't know if there was some sort of settlement reached between the UCI and the team. But, you got to think, particularly for teams that are, so much of pro racing, Diane, depends on the dollars being available from team sponsors. And so the value of having a guy like Peter Sagan winning, half a dozen or more stages during the Tour de France is a huge value to those team sponsors. And so certainly a loss of potential revenue or a loss of potential value to the team by not having him in the race.
It could work in their favor in the, retrospectively saying, hey, we've been exonerated. Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Dan Worry. We are wrapping up the 2017 cycling season, both on the competitive and on the domestic side, meaning non-competitive. I hope that Peter Sagan comes back and you know, like, shows them what it's all about, which I think he will.
I suspect he will.
I suspect he will, too. You know, this we finally got this tax reform, which I'm using sort of euphemistically for something, but I'm not sure what it is. They got a tax bill passed. But in the pittance that was the bicycle commuting benefit, $20 a month that an employer could legally reimburse workers for commuting to work, it was eliminated this week. So, you know, these petty things that help cyclists, there's no infrastructure bill. Now they've taken away the $20 in commuting that you could, it's a tax benefit to the employer. As a cyclist could go and get service, buy tubes, do things that would help him get to work. And, you know, there are a lot of people who want to commute to work as opposed to bringing their cars. So I thought that that was kind of one of, and that just came up, that it was in the tax bill, that this $20 was eliminated. And I don't know how many people took advantage of it. They figure it was about a $5 million piece that took it out of the tax bill. It seems pretty petty to me, though. What do you think?
Wow, you know, this is actually the first time I'm hearing that news. And so it does seem like a sort of petty thing to, you know, that's not a great value, but it's certainly a value to the cyclists who are commuting. So sad to hear that. I was not aware.
It was retained in the House version of the bill, but eliminated in the Senate. And so the reconciled plan, it says, released by the Joint Conference Committee on Friday, stuck with the Senate's elimination. So that's kind of sad. I feel badly. Now, there may be some employers who just say, you know what, it's not that big a deal. I only have two or three people who commute to work. I'm going to keep it there. That would be the kind of employer I'd want to work for, right?
I would think so.
Yeah. What else you got?
Well, you know, the next memory of 2017 actually sort of piggybacks off what we were just talking about with Peter Sagan and you know, the sponsorship values. And that is that we almost lost one of America's best established pro cycling teams in what we now know as Cannondale Drapac. Previously was the Garmin team of Slipstream Sports. You might know, Diane, that team announced back in July during the Tour de France that a new sponsor had come on board, Oath, which was a media company owned by Verizon. They were coming on board not as a title sponsor, but certainly as a support to that team. And then just several weeks later, about 5-6 weeks later, team manager Jonathan Waters had to email all of the riders on the team and communicate to them that the team just may not continue into 2018, but basically releasing them temporarily from their contractual obligation and giving them the opportunity to begin seeking new teams. And so this is really, arguably America's best established, pro cycling team at that elite level. Very concerning, obviously, to many American pro cycling fans. There was a crowdfunding campaign begun, and then very much credit to our former Secretary of State and former U.S. Senator John Kerry. I don't know if you know, Diane, but Secretary of State Kerry is a huge cycling fan and cyclist himself.
Yes.
And is credited with bringing on additional sponsorships. And so at the last minute here, Education First, EF, is a company that runs international kind of educational tours where you can go and, you know, travel the world and have tour guides and so on. So Education First has come on. We'll have Education First Drapac as the team for next year. And, fortunately, Waters was able to get back a hold of the riders and say, hey, hold up on finding new teams because our sponsorship has been secured. And it sounds as though, hopefully they're in a more solid place now, even for the next couple of years. But, it just goes to show, how perilous this existing team structure and the pro tour license structure is, where, you know, it's very much a year-to-year question of whether a team will exist, and that's based on sponsorship and based on their ability to get into the biggest races in the world. And so we continue to have a broken system of team licensure and sponsorship and economics in the sport, but certainly glad to know the team formerly known as Garmin will continue for the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's really good. I can remember when Kerry was in Europe and went out on a bike ride, fell. I think he broke his leg. And at that point, it was interesting. I contacted the State Department, and then for the next year, I was getting State Department emails. It was so interesting. They kept me up to date on how he was doing, and then, you know, he was back in the States, and he was doing well. Well, that's really, really cool. What a wonderful story. So I have another feel-good stories instead of all of these, you know, kind of bad stories. You remember Alexei Graywall?
I do.
He was our Olympic gold medalist from the 1984 road race. He asked his girlfriend, Kamal Mani Bala, to marry him this week, and she said yes. So big congratulations to them both. They are an adorable couple, and it's just really, really cool. So I wish them many, many years of happiness and good health. So that was kind of a cool one. Yeah, wasn't
well,
that
me
cute?
As well. Congratulations.
Yeah, really, really. The second one, a good feel-good story, is about Roy Nickman. Now, he was in the same Olympics. He was a bronze medalist in the team time trial. I don't know if you know this. He is a firefighter.
I did not know that.
Yes, and he was at the Thomas fires in California for 2 weeks without coming home. And so they finally, his superior finally let him and his team go home for the holidays. And so they are all safe. So they marked themselves safe. And I thought that that was a really cool kind of cycling related story, that we have some real human stuff going on. He was posting these pictures from this fire that were just terrifying, terrifying. So it's really good to know he's home.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What you got next?
Well, so I will continue in your tradition of moving on to some feel-good stories.
Oh, good.
And that is Corinne Rivera. Now, you know, Corinne Rivera is a name that we have known for many years, obviously, particularly here in the United States. She is the holder of more than 70, I believe it's 71 now, national cycling titles across multiple different disciplines. She began as a very young woman. In fact, it's funny, if you can go and check, you know, Google her name, and images will pop up that, you know, that really show her really beginning as a child in competitive racing. So 25 years old, feels like she's been around for a long time, and certainly has been, but still a very young woman. Had a lot of success, you know, particularly when she was riding for United Healthcare on the domestic criterium circuit, but has really, during 2017, established herself as one of the very best cyclists in the world, and in particular, Diane, became the first American man or woman to win the Tour of Flanders this year, and so is now racing for Team Sunweb. But, you know, even with 70-plus national titles to her credit, you know the importance of the Tour of Flanders in cycling, and so, you know, just great news, and I think it has taken a homegrown cycling hero who we have known here in the States very well and really placed her firmly on the radar internationally.
Well, and it's nice to see women cycling looking like that. It's nice to
Absolutely.
See the face of cycling has a woman's face on it. It's awesome. So I have another really, it's kind of a feel-good story, but kind of not. And, you know, it's one that wouldn't really end well, but it is my story of the year. Now, Ian Dilley is one of my favorite journalists in the bicycle world. I mean, he does do other things. But this week, he penned a story called One Last Shot. And it was about a guy named Wally Gia. He hadn't competed in years. Here's the subtitle. He hadn't competed in years. Hell, he hadn't ridden in years. But before his health took him down for good, 74-year-old Wally Gia was determined to race his bike again. So the story is heartwarming. It's heartbreaking. It's courageous. It's compassionate. And Ian's telling of it just hits you in the heart and soul. It might be the best holiday story you'll read all year. So if you want to feel the gamut of emotions from, you know, elation to just utter despair, I'm voting for it. Again, it is the One Last Shot. It was published on bicycling.com by Ian Dilley this week. I don't know if you've read it yet. But yeah, you need to get a box of Kleenex when you do. It was so good. So good. So I have a question about the Giro is being started in the Middle East this year. What are you hearing anything that's changed since the last time we talked about it?
I have not.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, there were some concerns that there would be protests and things like that. So I'm hoping that that doesn't happen. I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
Well,
yeah. So what have you got going for 2018? Do you have any?
Well,
yeah.
Well, so for 28, I mean, certainly watching as this Froome situation unfolds could have a major bearing on you know, the Grand Tours in particular. There was some discussion already that Chris Froome was planning to ride the Giro this year. You know, he already won now this year, arguably, the you know, the Tour de France Vuelta double. And so some speculation that he'll be riding the Giro in the Tour this year. Of course, that's all dependent on the outcome of this this anti-doping inquiry that is going on right now. So that's a big story to watch. You know, the other thing that is maybe not as consequential, but certainly interesting to watch. I don't know if you saw, Diane, but Alexander Vinokourov, who is a former Olympic champion, obviously, but a figure in the sport who has a long history of you know, a connection with doping and you know, bans for that. Vinokourov is actually going to face trial in March.
Wow.
In Belgium. For the corruption. It is alleged that back in 2010, in the 2010 running of Liège-Bastogne-Liège in Belgium, that he paid off his primary rival, Alexander Kolobnev, 150,000 euros, which is about $178,000, to let him win that 2010 running of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And so subsequently now, this has been a couple of years ago, a magazine got a hold of email correspondence between the two of them that sort of summarized this deal that they made and got record of two bank transfers that totaled, coincidentally, 150,000 euros that happened in two installments in July and December of 2010. And so Vinokourov and Kolobnev are actually going on trial in Belgium for corruption, for having, you know, the allegation at least being that Kolobnev was paid off to lose this race to Alexander Vinokourov. Obviously, in cycling, there's a bit of a lore around this idea of different people being paid off at one point or another. So it'll be very interesting to watch. I think, obviously, in Belgium, they take their cycling very seriously, and this is a big deal. So we'll see what happens in March.
It is a big deal. You know, there's a new book out that Velo News sent me called Descent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T. It is the story of Thomas Dekker.
Yeah.
I've been reading it in preparation for a conversation I might be having with him. I'm hoping I have with him there. He's going to be doling out these interviews very judiciously. But it's sort of his descent into, you know, finally just saying, I'm done, because he didn't start out. He started out as sort of an arrogant SOB, you know, a young kid who just did really, really well. And something happened, you know. I haven't gotten through the book yet, but I can see the pressure that some of these riders seem to be under to perform and to, you know, to move up in the rankings. It must be really, really difficult.
It is a jarring book. In fact, I recommend it. I, like you, am not quite finished with it yet, but it's a fascinating story.
Yeah. So it's Descent. If you're looking for something to read over these cold and miserable, we're cold and miserable up here in Ohio. Well, Dan, thank you so much again for taking time to help wrap up 2017. We'll catch up again in 2018. I hope you and your family have a happy, happy new year. And, you know, we'll see what happens with all of these situations going forward.
Absolutely. And I'm wishing you and all of your listeners a happy 2018 as well. Thanks, Diane.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, yeah. Dan's always so much fun. I learn more about the competitive end of our sport from him than I do from almost anyone else. You can read Dan's At the Back columns in Velo News. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I'd like to say thanks to both Dan and Evelyn Bourne for joining me on this last show of 2017. And once again, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to the show and to ask that if you have an extra moment and feel like expressing your thoughts about the show, won't you please post a review to Apple Podcasts for me? Remember, you can follow us on Facebook, Outspoken Cyclist, and Twitter, Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Allow me to wish you and your family a happy, healthy, and safe new year. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.